At Cameron, we've been studying let's see how best way to describe it. We started the first of the year this year with a two-year theme on, we've called it 12. And so basically I'm going through and dealing with all of the ways that the number 12 is used throughout the Old and the New Testament. And so I'm using it as what we might call a biblical theology and tracing the number 12. And so recently I started, the very first one, I just did an introductory lesson. By the way, I'm doing 12 lessons, one every 2 months for 2 years. So that turns out 12. The second one I just recently did, we talked about the 12 tribes and how basically I traced the history of the Old Testament in one lesson. But I wanted to make sure that people understood that when you see the term 12 in the New Testament, it is always going to be based on that foundational 12, which is the 12 tribes. Does that make sense to everybody? You know, if you see the number 12, whether or not it is actually connected to it or not, in a Jewish mind, it's going to bring up the 12 tribes. And so that's why I went there. Well, in the midst of this, I also mentioned, and we were not going to have time within the 12 lessons allotted to deal with the 12 minor prophets. And so because of that, I began at the first of the year also preaching through the 12 minor prophets. And again, you know, I believe that there's no mistake that there are 12 minor prophets, right? They used to all, circulate as a single scroll, if you want to use that term, you know, just a single document versus Jeremiah would have its own, Isaiah, or the major prophets would have their own. And they're simply called major because they are longer in the way that they were written. So, having said all that, today you're going to get a double dose of the minor prophets. I really enjoy the minor prophets, and I enjoy the prophets generally, but I really enjoy the minor prophets because of percentage-wise how much of the minor prophets are used and reiterated into the New Testament. Right? What you have when you deal with Jesus and what you have when you deal with even Paul or others, not James as much, but Paul and Jesus especially, and even John, is you'll have a contrast between law and what is in grace, if you want to use that term, or the new covenant, or, you know, we usually call it the New Testament, but that we're not dealing with just the books here, you're dealing with the gospel. Does that make sense with everybody? So you have the law, and you have gospel, and you have those two things kind of opposed to one another. But what you do not have opposed ever is the prophets and grace, or the prophets and gospel. Does that make sense? As a matter of fact, Jesus, other than Peter, was never called this except by his accusers, right? Meaning those toward the end of his life, as they were telling he was. And Peter, one time, he was never called by anybody else the Messiah. You know what he was called? Think back to Matthew 16. What do they call him? He says, "Who do people say that I am?" What do they say? The only person who called him Messiah was Peter. What do they call him? Some say you are the prophet, Elijah, or one of the Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. So what Jesus did, what Jesus said, the way that he carried himself, they did not see this as a messianic thing. They saw it as a prophetic thing. Does that make sense to everybody? And so now, once you get even into Acts and you get into Paul, the prophets are going to be quoted regularly. The only books out of the Old Testament are quoted more of that. You're talking about Deuteronomy's quoted a lot, maybe Exodus. The Psalter, believe it or not, or the Psalms are quoted more than any other book. And I've always found that fascinating, considering we look at the Psalter and say, well, this is pure emotion language, and you can't hang your theology on that. Well, apparently you can, right? Because Paul did a lot, and Jesus quotes from it a lot. Now, I'm saying all this to say, to convince us that the minor prophets are important because they are ushering in a period, the gospel itself. Does that make sense to everybody, what I'm trying to say? Because the law represents something completely antithetical in some ways to what Jesus brought. It's completely different. Jesus says, this is what law was. And Paul says, this is what the law is, but this is what grace is. This is what faith is. This is what justifies you instead. But you do not have that antithesis with the prophets. because they're representing another development in what we might want to call like progressive revelation. Has everybody ever heard that term before? If not, progressive revelation has just kind of been this catchword for, at the beginning was creation, and then you have Abraham, and then you have the law, and God is slowly revealing His will, His revelation, as we move through time. Does that make sense now? So progressive revelation would mean that the prophets are a more full theology than what you might have in the law. The law is just basically giving you, this is what I want you to do, and these are my commands, and you just follow them. And when you move into the prophets, they actually backpedal on some of that, and they'll say, God will say something like in Isaiah 1, I hate your new moon festivals. I hate your sacrifices. Instead, I want a contrite heart. So a very law-minded person would think, well, did you not tell us to bring these festivals? Did you not command us to bring offerings? And God would answer, well, yeah, I did. But what was their problem, according to the prophets? Their heart. Say, so, yeah, you're doing the law, but, I mean, is it really doing the law if you're just following it by the letter? And so that's why I'm bringing in these minor prophets as we talk about, you know, getting closer to the gospel, because they're what I would consider a fuller understanding of what God would have His people do. Yes, I want you to obey the law, but what good does that do you if I don't have your heart? You see? You know, what good does it do you if you're just obeying it just for the sake of you don't want a ticket? Right? And I'm obviously referring to our laws, but... So anyway, so let's go into Hosea. That's what we're going to talk about this morning. Unless anybody has any questions, comments, I would entertain those. Yes. John 4, yep. Yes, she does. She does. Mm-hmm. Or she says, I perceive that you're something different. Yeah. So, I mean, that's another place where somebody does. Yeah, very good. Mm-hmm. Very good. All right, so Hosea. And why does she call him the Messiah, by the way? Okay. Very good. And what was it that Jesus said that made her think about that? Yeah, very good. Yeah, very good. Very good. You know that story well. All right. Yeah, good. All right, I like it. All right, so let's go back to Hosea. Hosea. Is anybody familiar with Hosea? Other than just relatively, yeah, all right. Hosea is one of my favorite. Obviously, it's the first of the minor prophets immediately following Daniel in our Old Testament. So if you're looking for it, it's between Daniel and Joel. Joel is very small, so you'll very likely run right over it. Hosea. All right. Let me see where I want to start here. I'll read my notes here. The minor prophets are short, so I tell people it should be relatively easy to keep up with the reading. So after today, I will have dealt with Hosea, and then also partially Hosea, and then all of Joel. And so if you feel as if it's sweeping through, you can go back and read them today very easily, because they're both the minor prophets. You can read all the minor prophets today if you really set your mind to it. It might take an hour and a half. You know, they're pretty short. But the minor prophets are more familiar with what we might call our Christian sensibilities. Jesus, again, was called a prophet as well as Messiah. And so the tenor of the message is similar with Jesus as well as to the prophets. The minor prophets provide a corrective for God's people and a call to repentance and reconciliation. The people had become, and I have here in quotes, a people, meaning an ethnicity, a race, an ethnic group, rather than a followers of God. Does that make sense to everybody? By the time you get to the New Testament, one of Paul's major concerns with these people is, he says, the church is no longer about just being a Jew. What does he say? The gospel is that there is no longer Jew and Greek, slave and free, male and female, right? He says that this is no longer an ethnic group. You're no longer going to be able to keep the Sabbath, keep the food laws, and practice circumcision, and that be okay. He says, if you want to do that, that's fine. But you need to understand that that is no longer what constitutes the people of God. And notice all those things are ethnic things. He doesn't say, well, no longer are you going to be able to tell a Christian because they shouldn't be envious, or they shouldn't commit adultery, or they shouldn't, right? Because all those things they knew they ought not do. Those are moral aspects. His major concern is they're trying to draw a line between, you know, the ethnic Israel and what Paul would consider actual Israel. And that's Israel who follows with the heart. Does that make sense to everybody? And so what you have in the prophets is us slowly coming to the terms with this. The people had become okay with just being a nation, right? Or two nations at this point. Israel and what's the one to the south? Everybody familiar with the divided kingdom? Israel is to the north, and who was in the south? Judah. Very good. So you're actually dealing with two nations, Israel and Judah. Okay? Does everybody know where I am there? Or want me to go back and explain how that's so? No? You got it? Okay, I just want to make sure. Very good, because it could be confusing in seeing that there are two nations rather than one. But they begin to see themselves as nations and not the people of God, so to speak. Right? So they've just found themselves kind of wandering and doing whatever it is they wanted. And God is going to call them to task on that in most every one of the 12 minor prophets and the major prophets too. But in Hosea, he does it in a way that I think as an individual is very disturbing for us. Right? Particularly a married individual is disturbing for us. Because we begin to put ourselves in Hosea's shoes. And I used to say all the time, nobody wants to be a prophet. Particularly Hosea. Nobody wants that. Because they were madmen. You know, they were seen by the world as people that did crazy things because God told them to. Right? I mean, you tell me some stories other than Hosea, because we're about to go there, where the prophets did crazy stuff. Or at least what everybody else considered crazy stuff. Can you think of a few? Well, if it makes you feel better, the word prophesy means to kind of be out of your mind. So when they would prophesy, they would be doing crazy things. Yeah. You know, things that we would look and think, what are you doing? All right, so let's think back. You remember in the stories of the kings and the chronicles where you have the prophets all come together and the guy pretends to be a bull. Yeah. Remember that one? Okay, so that's one. Is that crazy or not? I'll let you decide. Or do we look at it in that way? Very good. It's very strange, all right? What about Isaiah having to lay on one side for several hundred days and then roll over? And then what about when he's told to bake something to eat over human dung? And then he asks God, please don't make me do that. So he says, fine, you can use animal dung. Remember that one? You remember when Isaiah is told to walk around with his bare bottom showing? As in to show the people of Israel, this is the way you're going to be brought out of here when you're taken into another land. Right? I mean, all of these things are the things that the prophets were asked to do. So they were seen as very strange. As a matter of fact, there's one, and I want to say it's Jeremiah, but I may be wrong in this. Because I'm just going off memory here. But where he's supposed to, it may be Isaiah, but he digs through the wall every day and he pretends like he's leaving town. And then he comes back and he's supposed to do it the next day. He digs through the wall and he pretends like he's leaving town. And this again is to show the people, is to get the people ready for what's happening. And so Hosea, now that we're coming back to him, what was he asked to do? Yes, find a woman, find a prostitute, and marry her. Right? That is what he's told to do. So let's just read chapter 1, verse 2. Chapter 1 just gives us the time that this is happening in these certain kings. So when the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to him, go take for yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. There's your reason. And we can look at it and think, well, that doesn't seem very fair. right? Hosea is asked to do this because the people, you know, I want the people to see what it is. And so I've used the term at Cameron a lot of times because Hosea is not the only one. There are many others who, what I call living parables, right? They are a parable living before our eyes, and we can look at them and try to decide for ourselves, you know, what is happening here, right? And to be honest with you, I feel like in some times I'm a living parable, right? I'm sure you felt that way before. God is using me, you know, and all this bad stuff that's happening to me, hopefully for somebody else's sake, if they'll just look at my life and do something different. Does that make sense? So I think that obviously that's what's happening here with Hosea. He's allowing him to take on what is happening to the people, but what he's going to do is something truly redemptive, because that's what God's going to do too. I agree. Yeah. I agree. And that's where my mind was anticipating was the disciples. They continually misunderstood what Jesus was doing. Right? Had they ever heard Jesus say, you ought to hurt somebody? Absolutely not. He was a man of peace. Can we agree with that? Can we agree he taught that his whole life? But what did they try to do when they came to get him? They tried to chop somebody's head off. And Jesus has to stay them, right? Because I think it's because they misunderstood what was going on. I agree, okay? And another proof is that 40 years from now, whoever's writing about what's happening now, even in our country and the world, will know more about it than we do. Right? Because they've had some time to go and then look back at all the happenings. But when we're going through it, it's hard to get a grasp on history. It's hard to get a grasp on it. So that's a very good point. I appreciate that. And so Hosea, other than the fact that God tells him, the people probably miss it. You know, they probably look straight past. They probably see, man, this guy is nuts. You know, why is he doing this? And yet, you know, it was for their benefit. And that's the part that's hard. Now, we're going to go on and read a few more, and then we're going to come back to the redemptive part. I want to make sure that we get to the redemptive part before the class is over. That's the major thing. Agreed. Right. Agreed. Yeah, I agree. Have what? Oh, that's what. Oh, don't get ahead. That's where we're going. You ready? This guy, he knows. Very good. So, now he's. Yes, yeah, so go ahead. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I agree. Thank you. And that's what he does. Now notice, as he was going to say, that he is asked to have children. Now before you read ahead, nowadays, why don't we name children what we do? You tell me. Don't anticipate where I'm going. I want you to tell me truly, in the days we live, why do we name kids the way we do? Why do we? You know, why would you name a kid something? I'm not saying it's bad or good. I'm just asking you why. Okay, to make a statement, all right. So, for example, with my son, I wanted a biblical name. So his first name is Asher, right? But I also wanted him to take my name, which just happens to also be biblical, but Daniel. So his name is Asher Daniel. That's the reason for his name. My daughter, on the other hand, though I would have liked a biblical name, when my wife and I were dating, you ever heard Vince Gill's song Adriana? I used to sing that to her when she was gone a lot. And so that's why my daughter's name is Adriana. There's a reason behind it. It is significant, but it's nothing, right? And so we have a lot of different reasons why. But in the Old Testament times, they would wait often. But after children were born, just to see maybe what they look like. Edom, for example, you remember why he was named that? Because he was red. Right, and that's what the name means. And there are several places like that where children's names begin to mean something, not just to them, but to other people. Now, I wouldn't call it lucky. I think I was blessed and that God maybe had given us the name Asher because he is a happy kid, and that's what his name means. All right, but with Hosea, we are not fortunate enough to have a name like that. God is so upset, he says, verse 6, well, first is the one is Jezreel, but I want to focus on the next two. Verse 6, then the Lord said to him, name her, this daughter, Loruhamah, because it means I will no longer have pity on the house of Israel or forgive them. Or in other words, I will have no compassion. That's the name of this child, Loruhamah. The next child, God says, name this one, a male, Lo-Ami, which means not my people. Because of the way that Israel has been, they are no longer my people.
I find it extremely interesting that in the Bible, his name is the name of the Lord.
Absolutely. So much so that names are changed. Yeah, every name has a meaning, and so much so that names are changed. Well, what was Abraham's father of many nations name before? It was that. Abram. All right. What about what about the name Isaac, for example? What does his name mean? Isaac. What's that? He laughs, or laughter. Right? And why? I think it was twofold. Laugh out of joy, but also you laughed. And so did Abraham. You laughed, and here he is. Right? Think about one that was changed. Jacob. The one who takes by the heel, or the one who supplants, or like a trickster, is what that name means. But his name is changed after he wrestles with God to Israel, or Israel, the one who wrestles with God, right? So, I mean, you see that names, thank you, that names mean something, all of them. You know, particularly when you look into the Old Testament, and I even argue in the New Testament, right? Because of our transliteration of out of Hebrew and Greek into English, we miss it, but the word Joshua, that's Jesus' name, is Joshua.
Yeah.
It means salvation. Right? There's a reason why God would have him name that. He says that, right? You're going to name him Jesus because he is going to be the salvation. Right? We're told that in the first part of the Gospels. Right? Do you think there's any significance to the one of the 12 that betrays Jesus is the tribe from which Jesus came? Judas. Yeah? I mean, there is significance to the name. Why was Paul's name changed from Saul? Yeah. So, I mean, there are names even into the New Testament still matter. As a matter of fact, we're told in Revelation, once we become Christians, we are given a new name. And it's written on a white stone, right? I mean, so this is something that is very significant because it signifies a new identity in some ways.
Paul, and I know Paul was also a Christian in Rome, but wasn't Saul the Jewish man?
Yeah, that's what most people would consider, that when he changed his vocation from teaching to the Jewish people primarily to teaching to Gentiles, he took on a new name.
Yeah.
Yeah, or possibly his name that was already there that would have been his second or third name because he was a Roman citizen. Does that make sense to everybody? Like most Roman citizens would have had several names, just like we would if it wouldn't have been, you know, Paul, and then that's it. It would have been, you know, maybe Saul, Paul of wherever, right? Just like when you read other ones, they don't have one single name. Like my name is Daniel Wayne Roberts. I have a surname, I have a middle name, and then I have my common name. So Paul may have had names, or he changed completely just for the sake of who he was speaking to. Yeah, it could have been anyone. We're not really told. We just know that there's a transition in the middle of Acts where he's no longer called Saul at all. Right? He is Paul. Yep, so very good. All right? So now, here's the part that I want to draw our attention to, though, because, I feel like, I don't want to leave us in this place where God is telling them, you are not my people, and that he's just completely casting them aside. There is a better reason why he has taken them in. He wants them to see it. All right? But the first thing I want you to see is in chapter 2. This is something that makes some people uncomfortable, and yet it is ubiquitous. In other words, it is everywhere in the Old Testament and the New. And that is the fact that Israel, and then following that, the church, is considered the bride of God. Right? Very good. All right? You have it all throughout the New Testament, and then you have it here in the Old Testament where there's an obvious representation here. Now, notice what God does, though. In chapter 2, verse number 7, we'll look at first, and then we're going to look at starting verse 14 after that. Or even starting verse number 2. In verse chapter 2, Jesus says, plead with your mother, plead, because she's not my wife, and I'm not her husband. And she put away this whoring from her face and this adultery from her, right? In other words, please ask her to stop doing what she's doing. Then he comes down to verse 7, he says, she shall pursue her lovers, but she will not overtake them. She'll seek them, but she shall not find them. And then she shall say, I'll go, and I'll return to my first husband, for it was better with me then than now. But God says, she has gone all over, looking, and this being Israel, of course, looking for what the world has to offer, all what these other nations have to offer, all what everything else has to offer. And I have created a situation where all that is going to happen is nothing but bad. And she's going to see that it was better when she was with me. And she's going to have to go through all those horrible times to come to that realization. And she's going to see that I am the one who can make her truly happy. And I am the one that she ought to be with. Okay, so we have that first inclination of this in verse 7. Right? Because notice verse 8, she didn't know. I was the one who gave her the grain, the wine, the oil, and then I'm the one that lavished upon her gold and silver that they used for Baal, which means another master. Therefore, I will take back my grain in its time. In other words, I'm going to take this stuff back. I'm going to humiliate her inside of all of her lovers so that she'll come back to me. Now, look at verse 14. This is, to me, one of the most beautiful portions of Old Testament Scripture. Because God not only here, he is not only waiting for her to come back. He is going to woo her and instigate her to come back. All right? And here it is out of God's mouth. Verse 14. Therefore, I will now allure her and bring her into the wilderness. And notice what wilderness, what does that conjure up in our mind referring to Israel? Very good. The wilderness wanderings. I took them out of Egypt, and I have them in the wilderness now all to myself, and this is the place where I'm going to convince them that I'm the one worth having. This is the place I'm going to feed them every day. All they got to do is walk outside and pick it up. Right? So, very good. So he says, therefore now I will allure her, I will bring her into the wilderness, and I will speak tenderly to her. And from there I will give her vineyards, make the valley of Achor a door of hope. There she shall respond as in the days of her youth, as at the time she came out of the land of Egypt. And on that day, says the Lord, you will call me my husband, and no longer will you call me my Baal or my Lord. Because I'll remove all that. And then verse number 19, and I will take you for my wife forever. I will take you for my wife in righteousness and in justice and steadfast love and in mercy. So he's showing through Hosea, I've asked you to marry this woman, and yet I, God, am willing to do the same thing. I'm willing to come to these people who have wandered around, even though I'm the one who gave them everything they have. They are living in this land because I brought them here. I drove out the people ahead of them slowly so that they could take over their land. They could take over their cities. They could take over their vineyards. He says, I did all of that, and they still wandered. They still left. They still treated me this way. And I could destroy him, and I could divorce him, and I would be very much in the right for doing that, would he?
Yes.
Absolutely. But he says, instead, what I'm going to do, and I want to see if I can come back. I'm going to see if they'll still listen to my voice and call me a husband. I'm going to see if that's the way that they'll respond. And for me, is that or is that not a powerful depiction of God's relentless pursuit of us, of His people, right? That He wasn't willing to just let us do our thing, at least in this case. There are places He does, right? I mean, there's no doubt about that. But here He comes to redeem them, to buy them, right? We skipped over that part this woman. Well, no, we'll look at chapter 3, and this will kind of show us the redemptive quality of this. So it's not just about maybe not. Here, the man has to buy this woman back. Okay, so verse 3. The Lord said to me again, go, love a woman who has a lover and is an adulteress, just as the Lord loves the people of Israel, though they turn to other gods and they love raisin cakes, meaning, you know, these things that are given to them from other places. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and a homer of barley and a measure of wine. And I said to her, you must remain as mine for many days. You shall not play the harlot. You shall not have intercourse with a man, nor I with you. And so he sets them apart. I mean, sets her apart, right? And so again, is this not showing this redemptive quality that God has come to offer Israel? Yes, that was chapter 3. Yeah, the whole chapter right there. Yeah, I read through verse number 3, but there's only two more verses left. So, yeah, so it's pretty much the whole chapter there. Now, this is a good depiction, too. I want to make sure I have a few minutes for this. Yes, very good. All right, so this is a good depiction, too. Notice verse number 16. Like a stubborn heifer, Israel is stubborn. Can the Lord now feed them like a lamb in a broad pasture? So here God is bringing an indictment in this case. Right? So here's what he's trying to show us. And I think this is a little bit of a foreshadowing of what the gospel brings. People want to live like a lamb in broad pasture. In other words, there is a relative amount of freedom there, right? There's this huge pasture, and you can go where you please. If you want to go get your drink of water, go ahead. If you want to go get something to eat over there, go ahead. If you'd rather walk over here and get something, then you can do that too. But he says Israel is not like that. Israel is like a stubborn heifer, and I have to lead them around by a cord. Right? The more we want to wander away, the tighter that leash becomes. Does that make sense? And so God says, you want to be led. How can I let you give you a broad pasture when all you want to do is wander away? Right?
Yeah.
Unless we think, again, that this is not a good depiction, does Jesus not do something very similar in the New Testament? There were 99 sheep who were able to be led in the broad pasture, but one left. Right? And rather than God allowing that one to just do what it does, what is it? I mean, this is, and it's quoted in at least 3 in the 4 Gospels. Very good. Very good. All right? Leaves them to go pursue this one. And then this is very similar to what you're seeing here. All right? Very good. Agreed. Very good. All right? Agreed. All right? So now look at 5:15. Chapter 5, verse number 15, and then we'll read on over into chapter 6. He says, I'll return again to my place until they acknowledge their guilt and seek my face. In their distress, they will beg my favor. So here God is saying, look, here's what I'm going to do now. I'm going to kind of disappear for a little bit until they decide I'm going to seek him. And then I'll decide to disclose myself. And then he says in verse 6, this is what they say. Come, let us return to the Lord, for it is he who has torn and he will heal us. Yes, he is the one who struck us down, but he will also bind us up. After 2 days, he will revive us, and on the third day, he will raise us up so that we may live before him. So again, you have, if they're willing to turn back, this offer of redemption. Now, granted, in their day, they may not have read it this way, but if Paul can do it, so can we. You know, Paul read everything backward, in light of who Jesus was, right? And so because of that, what do we hear when we hear third day? Jesus rose from the dead. Now, how can we not make that connection when it says, after 2 days, God will revive us, and on the third day, He will restore us, or raise us up so that we may live before Him. Now, so this is a precursor to what we would call the gospel later on, that the fact that Jesus came from the dead, that God even then offered, come, return to Him, and He will raise you up. Right? Jesus looks back to the Old Testament to see these type of things, right? He looks back to Jonah. 3 days and three nights in the belly of the whale, and he makes that connection there with the resurrection. So you have that sometimes there. Now, let's look a little bit farther, and then we'll take some comments and kind of close up. Chapter 6, verse number 6. This is that part where I began, about how God, where people kind of misunderstood what law was and what a nation was of God. And He says, "For I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice, the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings." He says, now if you want to play the ruther game, He says, sure, did I ask you for burnt offerings? Yeah. But if you're going to make me pick that you know me or that you offer me a burnt offering, I'm going to take the fact that you know me every time. Right? And then in this one above, I desire steadfast love, not sacrifice. Yes, I told you to give me sacrifices. But what good does that do if there is no love? What good does that do? And so this is, you start having this come in with the prophets, this idea where God's like, I am not okay with you going through the motions. I am not okay with you just being a nation that just does things. You know, the people of God are people whom I have their heart. Right? Anybody have any comments or questions for these last several minutes? I mean, I don't want to get into anything else at this point. So, yeah. Agreed. Agreed. Mm-hmm. Agreed. I've been guilty as anybody. I mean, I've come here and sang songs and done that, and my mind is elsewhere, my heart is elsewhere, and it's just not in it. Now, I think it's good to come and try to get ourselves in that mindset, but you know, we have got to, you know, see where we are. You know, take stock of it, you know, use Paul's term, examine yourself. Right? You remember we talked about taking the Lord's Supper. Examine yourselves, because otherwise you're eating and drinking condemnation. I mean, this is an important thing. You know, it's very easy to fall into this idea of just going through the motions and doing what we do, rather than allowing our hearts to be with God. And here's the hard part. I think you can help it along, but you cannot, I don't want to use the term manipulate, you cannot manufacture feelings, right? You know, it has to be something that's real. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. Agreed. And I like that you're using that term, laying it at the altar, right? Because, for Jesus, our relationship with others and our relationship with God is far more important than a gift we bring, right? Do you remember what He says in Matthew 5 and 6 in the Sermon on the Mount? He says, if you come to bring a gift to the altar and there you find and you remember that you have a problem with a brother, first leave the gift, because that's what good people do, right? Leave the gift and then go. No, He doesn't say that at all, does He? First, seek reconciliation and then come and offer this gift. And what He's showing is that more important than that gift is our relationship with our brothers, which, again, in turn, affects our relationship with God. You see that? And so I agree. You know, it's all about coming. And it's here. Anybody can come and offer a gift. But is that gift offered in a way that's right? You know, what are my offerings? You know, what is it that I'm giving over? Any other comments or questions? Really appreciate it. We're just now out of time. So hopefully we're going to transition into Joel. And he will have some very similar things to say But I felt like Hosea for the class time was something that is truly powerful in the way that God just doesn't allow us to wander. He says, "No, I'm gonna come and see if I can win you back." So, very good. Thank you.
Thank you.